The director was a woman named Selby Abbott. She was tiny, blonde, wore dark jeans and a simple white shirt, had an aristocratic Tidewater accent, ramrod straight posture, and the frankest, most unwavering gaze I'd seen in a long time. She could not have been nicer to us, but even so, I got the feeling that Selby Abbott was someone with whom you would not want to mess. After we'd introduced ourselves and Selby had led us back to her immaculate office, she said, "Welcome to Andrew Pfeiffer, Claire and Dev. What's your story?" And even though we hadn't told our full story at any of the churches, I found suddenly that I wanted to tell it to Selby. "Our story," I said, and paused.
"Go ahead,"
said Dev. So I told as efficient a version of it as I could, glossing quickly over the part about leaving Zack practically at the altar, and I was on fairly firm ground until I got to the part about the city abbreviations and our trip to Richmond because, as I described it all out loud and to a complete stranger, I realized how flaky and impulsive it sounded, how much like a fool's errand. But the crazy thing is that while Selby had appeared fully engaged from the very start, when I got to the Richmond part, she leaned toward me, locked her attention in even harder, and when I'd finished, she said, "Oh, my God." Not as in, "Oh my God, you two are idiots, thank goodness," but more like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." "What?" I asked. She opened a desk drawer, rummaged around for a few seconds, pulled out a brochure, and handed it to me. "It's Andrew," she said excitedly. "It has to be. Okay, maybe it doesn't have to be, but I really think it is." The brochure was for the center's 30th anniversary gala and fundraiser. "Go to page 4," she said, "and read." Dev scooted his chair closer to mine, took one side of the brochure in his hand while I held the other, and with our heads almost touching, we read. The center had been started by an elderly woman and her friends. The woman was Lillian Pfeiffer, the widow of the Reverend Andrew Pfeiffer, who had died just the year before. Reverend Pfeiffer had been a remarkable man, although almost no one realized exactly how remarkable until after his death, when Lillian finally told his story. One day in the early 1930s, when Andrew was a young assistant rector, a woman and her son had come to his church. The woman told Andrew and his superior, the rector, that beginning about a year after they'd been married, her husband, a wealthy man prone to wild rages, began to beat her. She told Andrew and the rector that the beatings were getting worse and that she feared for her life and for her son, who looked to be about 9 or 10. She asked them to help her. Despite the terribleness of her story, the rector sent her back home to work on her marriage. Although Andrew never found out what became of the woman, and indeed did not even know her name, her story, her palpable fear and sadness, and as she left, her air of utter hopelessness, haunted him for decades. Almost 20 years later, around 1950, when his and Lillian's children were teenagers and he had a church of his own, Andrew became part of a secret relocation effort for victims of domestic violence. He organized a wide network of carefully chosen ministers and rabbis and other like-minded people who identified abused women and their children in their communities and sent them to Andrew Pfeiffer's church. They would arrive in the dead of night and stay a day or two in a back room until a car came, picked them up, and took them far away to safety. While Lillian knew the basics of what was happening, for her own safety, Andrew never gave her details. She didn't know the names of any of the other people involved. She didn't know who the women were, or where they came from, or where they went when they left Andrew's church. While she cooked food for Andrew to take to the women and children, she never set eyes on a single one of them. Not until I came to the end of the story and heard Dev say, "Ow," did I realize I'd been holding on to his free hand, squeezing it tighter and tighter as I read. "Sorry," I said. I dropped his hand, and as he shook it out and flexed his fingers with what I regarded as more drama than necessary, he said to Selby,
"I'll bet you're right. It all fits. The timeline is right. But did Lillian ever mention the names John Blanchard or Edith Heron? Like maybe it was John who picked the women up and drove them away?"
Selby shook her head.
"She never mentioned names, at least not to the reporters who wrote the articles about Andrew. And if she mentioned them to my predecessor, I never heard about it."
"Wait," I said. "You never met her?"
"No. I didn't start working here until 2000. I believe Lillian passed away in the mid-90s.
I sighed. "Oh, I was hoping we could talk to her."
"Yeah,"
said Dev.
"She might have been able to tell us something, some little detail that she didn't tell the reporters.
Selby's face brightened.
Why, hey, her daughter Abby Stewart is on the board of the center. Why don't you give me a cell number and I'll see if she wouldn't mind calling you. Would that help?
I smiled. Yes, that would be great, actually. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for everything,
said Dev.
No one would have blamed you if you thought we were crazy, and here you are going above and beyond.
Selby clasped her hands under her chin.
Andrew Pfeiffer is kind of a household god around here.
She grinned and instantly looked about 11 years old.
Plus, I spent a good chunk of my childhood being obsessed with Nancy Drew. I just love a good mystery.
Ditto, I said, laughing.
On both counts.
Dev and I ate dinner at a Thai restaurant because it was the first place we came to that we could agree on, the only drawback to Thai being that we couldn't share, since my philosophy about Thai food is that if your tongue doesn't practically burst into flames while you eat it, it isn't worth eating, a philosophy with which Dev adamantly and wimpily disagrees. When we'd eaten ourselves right to the edge of oblivion and were toddling out to my car, my phone rang, or vibrated, actually, and I looked down at it, expecting to see Zach's name on the screen. During dinner, he'd texted 4 times, and each time he'd written exactly the same words, ones that sent a chill up my spine and caused me to glance over my shoulder and at the restaurant's big plate glass window, even though I knew what he wrote couldn't possibly be literally true.
I know you're with him right now.
But this was a number neither my phone nor I recognized. Area code 804. Abby Stewart. Dev and I got inside the car, and Abby Stewart let me put her on speaker, so that when she broke the news that she'd never heard anything about a John Blanchard or an Edith Heron from her mother, had never heard any names at all, Dev and I were able to be disappointed together.
Even though this was all going on while I was in high school, I never knew a thing about it until after my dad died and my mom told me. I do know that my father was just a cog in the wheel, a big cog for sure. He took a lot of risks, but he wasn't the one running the machine. He wasn't the mastermind. Another man had the idea and sought my father out, recruited him, I guess you could say. When the women and children left my father's church, not even my father knew where they were going. A car picked them up and took them away. My mother didn't share that information with the reporters because she didn't want them digging around trying to find the guy. She only told me that he existed shortly before her death.
Who was it?
Asked Dev. We held our breaths.
Oh, someone with deep pockets, said Abby Stewart. My mother told me that my father never used his name in front of her, just referred to him as Mr. Big City. He was from someplace up north, she said. My father said he was a man with power and money and a load of rage. He channeled it toward doing good, obviously, but it was rage nonetheless. My dad said a man with that much anger must have had first-hand knowledge of domestic violence.
Do you know how long your father was part of this operation, this Underground Railroad? I asked.
Until the mid-50s, I think, 56, 57. It ended abruptly. For reasons unknown to my dad or mom, Mr. Big City just called the whole thing off. Well, my dad felt guilty about stopping, but the tide was already turning. In the early 60s, my dad and other like-minded people began to establish shelters, small ones, and my dad spent the rest of his life working to educate his congregation and the public about domestic violence. He was a good man.
He was, I said.
And your mother was obviously a good person, too,
said Dev.
She helped establish the women's center and everything.
She was tireless,
Abby Stewart chuckled.
And relentless about raising money to keep the place up. People used to say that Lillian Pfeiffer could squeeze money out of a stone.
Thank you for talking to us, I said.
It's my pleasure, she said. I mean that. I haven't talked about my parents much recently, although I think about them and miss them every day. I'm truly grateful for the chance to tell someone about them. Now you have to promise to let me know if you find out anything else, and oh, Lord, let Selby know too. You've got her interest piqued. That woman loves a good mystery.
We promised. After we hung up, we sat for a minute, not talking.
Rich, powerful. It doesn't sound like John,
said Dev. I know. I could hear how crestfallen that I know came out, but even so, my tone didn't come close to conveying how let down I felt.
Hey,
said Dev, tugging a lock of my hair.
We found out a lot on this trip, didn't we? A lot more than I thought we would.
I looked at Dev. Of all the people whose bubbles I hated bursting, Dev topped the list. But it seemed wrong not to tell him what I was thinking. I groaned. Okay, I hate saying this, but if I don't say it, I might fret about it for weeks, and I might do that anyway, but since we're in this thing together, I just think I should say it. What do you think?
Go for it,
said Dev.
We can at least fret together.
Well, isn't it possible that Mr. Big City's machine and Edith's shadow ledger aren't related at all? That it's just a coincidence? But there's nothing here really to absolutely connect Edith or John to any of what we've dug up.
I agree that some kind of irrefutable proof would have been nice, and sure, it's possible that what you're worrying about is true, but I don't think so. Mr. Big City called it quits at right around the same time as Edith left and John got arrested. Everything fits too well. They were all in it together.
Even though I knew Dev couldn't be 100% sure of that, not as sure as he sounded, I felt relieved anyway. So Edith and John were other cogs in the machine. The shadow guests stayed at Blue Sky House for a night or two, and then someone, maybe John, took them to wherever they went next, I said.
Probably not John, though,
said Dev.
It could have been, but it might have aroused suspicion, the police chief leaving town mysteriously on a regular basis. Mr. Big City probably sent a car to Edith's house, too.
And Sarah and her baby? How do they fit? I mean, they kind of don't. Sarah wasn't from Virginia. She was a local woman. She had killed her husband, and she wasn't written down in the shadow ledger. All of that makes her different from the others.
Okay, so Sarah and the baby weren't part of Mr. Big City's escape machine, not at first. Relocating her and her baby was a spur-of-the-moment decision, and I think it probably all unfolded a lot like John said it did in court.
I nodded. What he left out was that he and Edith had done it before. There was a system in place. They just slid Sarah and her baby into it.
You'd make Nancy Drew proud,
said Dev. He raised his palm and I slapped it. You too. But neither of us sounded especially happy. We should have been triumphant because Dev was right when he said we'd found out a lot. But mostly what I felt was deflated, even sorrowful. I think, I began.
What?
Said Dev.
Well, maybe this is it. We've figured out all we can figure out.
He smiled and leaned over to bump my shoulder with his.
Unless you want to go scour every major northern city looking for Mr. Big City.
Sounds fun, actually, I said. Then I sighed. I just wish we'd learned more of Edith's story.
We don't know the middle part, all those years. I guess we'll never know it.
Dev brightened.
But we know how it ended.
My eyes filled with tears. We know that whatever happened during those years, she survived it all. She lived on, even after leaving everything she knew behind. She became an amazing person.
And she left you her house,
said Dev. She was taking care of me, a woman she didn't even know. I wiped my eyes and smiled, like she took care of all those other women. She was worried about me, so she gave me a safe place.
A sanctuary.
Outside the car, dusk had ended, and the summer night surrounded us. Pinprick stars floated above the trees edging the restaurant parking lot. I couldn't find the moon. So this is where Edith's story ends, I guess, I said.
With you,
said Dev.
You're Edith's happy ending.
Honestly, right now I feel sad.
Hey, happy endings aren't allowed to be sad.
I suddenly understood that, yes, I was sad that we hadn't found out all of Edith's story, but that wasn't the entire reason. I wanted to ask Dev my favorite question. It was there, hovering above us, singing itself over and over like a mockingbird, waiting for one of us to ask it. But what I realized right then was that if you didn't have an answer to it, the question lost its magic. And if the answer were nothing, so what's next became in an instant the saddest question in the world. I wish this weren't over. I'll miss... I found I couldn't look directly at Dev, so I stared out the windshield. The search, I finished. After a few seconds, Dev said,
I'll miss that too.
Chapter 21 Edith December 1956 Before she noticed the smear of blood on his tan windbreaker, before he had spoken a single word, Edith knew, not exactly what he was going to say to her, but that whatever it was would change everything. Tranquil John. John of the steady voice and unflappable nerves, cerulean-eyed, eye-of-the-storm John stood on her porch, lips pale, weight shifting from foot to foot, hands rubbing together as if he were trying to warm them. Indeed, he was shivering, head to toe, shivering in bursts, as if electric shocks were running through him. And because it troubled her, the sight of him cold, and maybe also because she wanted to buy a moment, to postpone knowing whatever frightening thing he had come to tell her, she opened her front door wider and said, scolding him, "That flimsy jacket's not enough for this weather. For heaven's sake, come in." He came in and she shut the door behind him, but the shivering persisted. She saw the blood, then, a handprint like children make in school on his jacket, dashes of it on his white shirt, still a wild red fresh blood, and panic shot through her.
"Oh, God, you're hurt."
She reached toward him, but he stepped back, dodging her touch. "I'm fine." He stared down at the blood as if he were seeing it for the first time. "I shouldn't have come. I don't want to visit this trouble on you, but I didn't know. I couldn't think what else to do," he said.
"Of course you should have come," she said.
He shook his head. "However this thing plays out, if you're involved in it, you'll be at risk. More than you've been so far." John pressed his hands to the top of his head, trying to calm himself. When he dropped them to his side, the shaking had abated, but he looked at her with stricken eyes. "You can say no, and, God help me, Edith, you should say no. Just say that one word, and I'll go away and never mention this again." Edith remembered John on the beach in the pouring rain, how he'd found her wandering in the storm and brought her home, how he'd warmed her and talked to her and stayed all night.
"You're my true friend, and I'm yours," she said. "Whatever you're asking, I'm saying yes."
"You can still say no after I tell you."
"I won't."
Suddenly cold, she pulled her hands inside the cuffs of the sweater she wore, one of Joseph's. Now that it was winter, she'd taken to dressing this way when she was home alone, her body cocooned, lost inside Joseph's oversized clothing, safe and warm.
"I parked my car in the dark place down the street," said John. "There's a woman in it with a newborn baby. She shot her husband, not half an hour ago. The man's dead, Edith."
The rest of the miserable story tumbled out. By the time John was saying, "Anyway, I was hoping maybe you could do for her what you've done for the others," Edith was already putting on her coat. Her name was Sarah. For a woman who had recently given birth, for any woman, Sarah was thin, stark jawline, broomstick arms, her back a frightening relief map of bones, and more horribly hurt than any woman who had ever passed through Blue Sky House. John carried her from the car to Edith's back door. Edith carried the baby, Stephen, who did not cry but merely regarded her with his almond-shaped eyes. Edith centered the baby on the cot in the corner of the room as John placed Sarah gently on the bed, leaving the room immediately afterward so that Edith could examine her. Sarah's face was ashen where it wasn't bruised or bleeding, one eye purple, swollen shut, her throat, back, breasts, ribcage, arms, legs covered with bruises like ink stains, some of them new. Edith gently dabbed some ointment on her split lip. Edith heard a clattering sound outside and froze, but when John didn't reappear, she assumed it was just the wind and went back to her examination. When Edith pressed carefully on Sarah's abdomen, Sarah moaned. As soon as John came back into the room, Edith pulled him aside and said,
"I'll do what I can." But her distended abdomen, the pain, those dark purple splotches on her stomach could mean she's bleeding internally.
"She should be in the hospital," said Edith.
"If we take her to one, she's sure to be arrested," said John. "Her husband was rich, well-connected. Word of this will spread like wildfire."
Sarah's eyes were shut, her dark hair shining against the pillow. She must have been beautiful, thought Edith. And then, bitterly, sometimes beauty is a curse. She has no fever, not yet, she said. We may have some time to work with, but I just don't know. I can't know the extent of the damage. Wherever the car takes the other women, said John, there must be hospitals. There must be, said Edith, but I don't know where they go or how long it takes to get there. I don't know anything. That's how this works. We should ask her what she wants to do, said John. Edith walked to the bed and said, Sarah? The woman opened her good eye. It was a remarkable color, ice blue, almost silvery, and, despite everything, alert, to Edith's relief. Sarah listened to Edith and then said, I won't go to a hospital. If I'm in prison, what will become of Stephen? She could barely get the words out. A bruised larynx, thought Edith. Do you have family who could take him? Edith asked. Sarah laughed, a terrible, broken-down wheeze of a laugh. My husband's people would never let that happen. She reached out and clutched Edith's hand and said fiercely, They are fiends, all of them, cruel and heartless. Would you want your child raised by people like that? If I die or get caught before we get to the safe place, promise me you'll never let Stephen go back to them. Promise me you'll find good people to raise him. Edith couldn't bring herself to tell Sarah that she wouldn't know where she was going or whether she and her baby ever arrived. Instead, she said, I'll find a way. I promise. She turned to John. We shouldn't wait until morning. If she's leaving, it will have to be tonight. The sooner the better. John nodded. I need to make a phone call, said Edith. For the first time, Edith called the number George Graham had given her. A woman answered, took Edith's information, and hung up. When 10 minutes passed without George calling her, she began to pace, her hands clasped hard against her sternum, and, for the first time in years, to pray. 10 minutes later, the phone rang. She spilled Sarah's story out in one long stream. It was the first time she'd spoken to George since she had ended their relationship, but she didn't have time to feel awkward. When she was finished, she waited for George to give her instructions, tell her when the car would arrive. Instead, his voice came at her like a knife. Don't be foolish, Edith. Do you think the driver of that car waits down the road for me to call him? He's hours away. Even tomorrow morning would be too soon, and that woman and her baby need to get out of your house tonight. Get out? And go where? Asked Edith, confused. I don't know. Figure something out. Jesus God, Edith, a murderess? A man from a prominent family? A woman people might recognize and with an infant? People will be looking for her. They're probably already on the hunt. I need your house, Edith. Don't you understand that? I understand that her husband would have murdered her if she hadn't killed him first. You haven't seen the horrible damage he did to her. Then she should be in a hospital. Have that police chief take her there, immediately.
No. I promised her I wouldn't. If I do that, she'll be arrested.
You promised? He said acidly. It was not your place to promise.
Edith said nothing, and when George spoke again, his voice was calmer.
I'm sorry, Edith. Listen. Have the police chief take her to the hospital. Have him do it right away, and if she is arrested, I'll help her. I will get her the best lawyer money can buy. I know lawyers who could get the devil himself off. But she has to swear not to mention you or your house to anyone. That's my one condition. Be sure she understands. If she does mention your house, if she says anything about it at any point, I will withdraw my assistance, and God help her then.
For the first time, Edith felt shame at having ever put her hands on this man. She sat down heavily in the chair near the telephone, trying to gather her scattered thoughts. After a moment, she took a breath and said, No.
Damn it, Edith.
She could lose her baby. Her husband's family could find a way to take him from her.
And what about all the other women and babies? The ones still out there who I haven't saved yet. I've spent years putting this system in place, fine-tuning it. If the police start looking too closely, it could all collapse and take you and me with it. I'm sorry, but no. Do what I say, he said loudly. If you can't send a car tonight, tell me where to take her. I'll drive her and the baby myself. You must be insane. I'm not telling you anything. Edith sat for a moment, thinking, then said, If you don't, I'll spill the beans. Every last one. I know the first names of all the women who have come through here. I know where they're from because they always tell me. It won't take the authorities long to find you and to blast everything you've built to hell. How dare you? He hissed. Do you think you can blackmail me? I don't think I can. I'm doing it. Right now. After she hung up the phone, Edith leaned over with effort and let the blood flow to her head. When the stars shooting across her vision had disappeared, she stood up and walked into the bedroom. There's been a change of plans, she said. The car can't get here in time. I'm driving Sarah and Stephen. What? Said John sharply. Where? She held up her notebook. I have directions to a safe house in Canada. It will be a long drive, so we should leave right away. Oh, no, John said. Not you. I'm taking her. It could take days to get there and back, John, she said. You have a job. People will wonder where you are. They might even get suspicious. I don't have any guests scheduled for the rest of the winter. John's eyes glinted. I don't care, Edith, he said. I won't let you do this. Be reasonable. A woman no one cares about going on a trip won't raise any eyebrows. The chief of police disappearing will. And what will you do? Take your police cruiser? Take my car and leave yours here for everyone to see? It won't work. If you're not concerned about yourself, think of Sarah and the baby. They'll have a better chance of getting where they're going if I take them. Edith, said John, his voice ragged with emotion. What if you're caught? We won't be. Even if someone stumbles onto our trail, which is very unlikely, the directions I've been given are designed to throw people off. Back roads, small towns, swinging wide, looping back. It's not the fastest route, but it's safe. And at the border, there will be an officer in place who is part of the system. I'm the one who brought her here, said John. I should go. Thank you for wanting to. But you must see that it doesn't make sense. You'll take care of things here. Think of a story to explain my absence if the need arises. I'll be back before you know it, and this will all be over. No, said John quickly. Give me the address of the house in Canada, and I'll send a wire letting you know when it's safe to come back. Startled, she said, Why? Why wouldn't it be safe right away? It will be, he said, but just in case. As Edith wrote the address down on a piece of notebook paper, she found her hand was shaking, which surprised her. All through her conversation with George, she had stayed collected. But now, here with John, she felt close to breaking down. She took a few long, steadying breaths before she tore the page from her notebook, folded it, and handed it to John, her eyes meeting his. I'll wait to hear from you, she said. I should never have brought you into this, said John. I'm so sorry. Nonsense, she said, smiling at him. You gave me a choice, remember? I chose this. John nodded, wearily. All right. All right. You should go now, said Edith. I can get Sarah and Stephen to my car by myself, and the longer you stay, the longer your car sits empty on the street, the greater the risk. At the door, John turned to her, his expression unguarded, stripped bare and so full of love that she had to hold back a gasp. A thought flew into her head. Oh, God, what if I don't see this man again? But she would. She would. John moved toward her, as if to kiss her or take her in his arms. But she put out her hand. Goodbye, she said. I'll see you soon. He took her hand and pressed it to his mouth, and then John Blanchard was gone.
Chapter 22. Claire. I couldn't let it go. I didn't even know what I hoped to find. Mr. Big City's identity? Proof that Sarah and her baby had found sanctuary in the end? John Blanchard's story after he was released from prison? The missing 50-plus years of Edith's life? Yes. No. I didn't know. And more important, I didn't know why it mattered so much, so extraordinarily much to me. Apart from understanding that what urged me on was more than simple curiosity, I understood nothing else about my own motivation. I tried asking myself, what if you answer all your questions, fill in all the blanks, what will it give you, what will it change? But all I came up with as an answer was something. Maybe it was the house that spurred me on. Maybe it was Edith, the Edith of Blue Sky House, who had loved Joseph, who had slept with him under the blue sky ceiling, who had paddled a canoe, who had collected leaves and bones, who had suffered Joseph's death, who had run a business, who had given refuge again and again, who had written down the names of the shadow women and their children in order to make them real, to bear witness, to say that nothing is ever truly erased. Or maybe it was the Edith of my wedding weekend, sharp-eyed, clear-voiced, human, and also spun together out of earth and sky, giving me courage, persuading me to find a way to lift my home onto my shoulders and carry it with me. I searched for their names, collected Herons and Blanchards, but never the ones I wanted. I researched Wickham Flaherty, the New York law firm that had represented John during his trial, but it had closed in the 1960s. After the tragic deaths of John's lawyer, Randolph Flaherty, and his son, Randolph Flaherty Jr., in a sailing accident. I wondered how a small-town police chief would even know about the existence of Randolph Flaherty, Esquire, and I wondered how he could possibly have paid him. I wondered if Mr. Big City had signed those checks, if New York were the big city of Mr. Big City. I kept thinking that as soon as I found something, I would call Dev. But I didn't find anything, so I didn't call. He didn't call me either. We hadn't spoken in the 4 days since I'd dropped him off at his house on my way back from Richmond. I wasn't angry at him. I didn't not miss him. My nights were emptier without his voice in them. But I just kept hearing that question. So what's next? So what's next? So what's next? And I imagined that Dev felt like I did, suspended in the empty space where the answer should have been. Then, one evening, he called. Before he even said hello, he said,
"Are you okay?"
"I'm okay. Are you okay? Because you don't sound especially okay."
"How do I sound?"
"Worried. Or, no, mad. But actually, both. Murried? Wad?"
"You do sound weirdly okay,"
said Dev. "Gee, thanks."
"So what's up with your Facebook page?"
he demanded. "Now you sound mostly just mad. Also, what are you talking about? I almost never go on Facebook," I said. I jumped on briefly right after, in the car making my getaway from my non-wedding, I'd taken down the engaged status I'd only ever put up at Zach's very persistent prompting, but I didn't feel like sharing that bit of information with Dev. Dev didn't say,
"Right after what?"
for which I was grateful. He said,
"How long ago was that?"
"Back in June and everything was normal," I said. "Everything on Facebook, I mean."
"Get on your computer and go to your page, right now."
"No Wi-Fi, bossy person. And hey, you're on Facebook even less than I am. How did you happen to be looking at my Facebook page anyway?" There was a pause.
"Irrelevant. You're missing the point here."
"Well, maybe if you made a point, I would stop missing it."
"Just get on your phone and look at your Facebook page, Claire."
"Are you speaking through gritted teeth? You know, that might work for Clint Eastwood, but honestly, it makes you a little hard to understand."
"Claire."
"Fine.
After you look, call me back."
He hung up. Dev was looking at my Facebook page. Even though there was no one in Edith's house with me to hear it, it was still satisfying to say out loud. But as soon as I took a look at the page, this satisfaction, along with every other remotely positive feeling, evaporated. I hate myself for what I've done to Zach, and to me. My life is so empty. I guess you never realize what you have until you've thrown it away like it was garbage. First his mother left him, then his sister Ro left him, then his father, now me. I feel like a sadistic monster. I can't get Zach out of my head. His face, his voice, his body against mine. I would do anything to get him back. Anything, 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 anything. The thought of never being with Zack again makes me wish I were dead. I just need this pain to end. Post after post after heartbroken, regretful, semi-suicidal post, all put up an hour ago. The proximity in time creeped me out, made him feel somehow near me, lurking, which I know didn't make sense, but I was rattled. And by rattled, I mean I felt like either taking a shower or throwing up or both, if not simultaneously, but instead, I deleted my account. Then I shot off a text to Zack. What the hell is wrong with you? Was that supposed to be a joke? Because it wasn't funny, as I'm sure you know. I called Dev back. It had to be Zack. He's the only person who knew my password. I guess I should have changed it back in June, but I'd forgotten he had it.
Well, he didn't forget,
said Dev.
Obviously.
I'm sorry you were worried.
Murried,
said Dev, correcting me.
Wad. And I'm sorry I was both of those completely non-existent adjectives.
That's okay. For the record, I don't feel any of the things he posted, not a whit.
No one says whit,
said Dev.
But hey, that's good news.
Mentally and emotionally, I'm tip-top.
Which is more than we can say for Zack.
Thanks to me, I said.
Nope, you can't take credit for this. Creepiness of this magnitude had to be in there waiting to happen. Sooner or later it would have.
I hope so. No, I mean I hope not. Ugh, I don't know what I hope. But while we were eating dinner in that Thai place...
Yes?
He texted me the same text 4 times. I know you're with him right now. I know you're with him right now. I know you're with him right now. I know you're with him right now.
You didn't tell me that,
said Dev. I didn't want you to get murried the way you do.
Seriously, do you think he did know?
Of course not. How could he?
He could have had you followed, hired a private detective or something.
I laughed. Zack might be crazy, but he's not that crazy.
It would be good to know, said Dev, just exactly how crazy he is.
My phone vibrated in my hand, and I took it from my ear and looked at the screen. Zack. He's calling me. I should get it, I said.
Okay, but Claire, don't tell him where you are.
I won't. Don't worry. He doesn't even know this place exists. He claimed to be drunk, a claim I had no trouble believing since I could practically smell the alcohol through the phone. He said he'd been drinking more lately, which his brother Ian said was understandable, even normal, even wise, at which point I wanted to remark that his brother Ian might not be the ideal go-to person when it came to identifying wisdom, but I refrained. He talked about numbing the pain and blunting the anger, but then he mentioned that he was angrier than ever, not every second, but in spurts. He talked about his sister Ro, about how for some reason he couldn't stop thinking about her, about how all his conversations with Ian seemed to lead back to Ro. He said he'd only written on my Facebook page what he wished I were feeling, presumably including the wish I were dead sentiment, but knew I didn't feel, unless deep down I actually did, which he suspected was true, since he knew the two of us would end up together in the end, and if he knew this, he bet I knew it too, deep down. I told him again that I would always care about him, but that I could never be with him. He ignored this. I told him that maybe he should consider going to a doctor, talking to someone, getting some help. He ignored this, too. I apologized again for hurting him. He didn't ignore this. He said that I should be sorry, that he hoped I'd be fucking sorry for the rest of my goddamned life. And then he hung up. How about I make a quick visit, just to be sure you're safe, my mother said when she called later that night. I heard about the Facebook thing. I sighed. From Dev?
From Cornelia, who heard it from Hildy, who heard it from Aiden, who heard it from Dev.
I only heard it from Dev an hour ago, I grumbled, sounding exactly like my 14-year-old, privacy-deprived, indignant self. But when my mother arrived in a whirlwind of sunglasses and linen and knife's edge pleats and blondness, I ran out so fast to throw myself into her arms that I nearly mowed down a squirrel. When she'd managed to untangle her elegant limbs from my hug, she took off her sunglasses and smiled. And I was struck for the 100 millionth time by how my mother would have looked exactly like Grace Kelly if only Grace had bothered to be just a teensy bit more polished. After we carried in her sleek overnight bag and the 4 tons of groceries she'd bought, I gave her a tour of the house, which I'd begun to think of as my house, although somehow this didn't seem to make it any less Edith's. My mother oohed and awed and ran her hand along some things and gazed at other things and got solemn and expressed reverence in all the right places. We made sandwiches and picnicked at the beach and then went for a long walk on the sand, during which my mother, in her black one-piece swimsuit, raffia sun hat, and a silk sarong knotted around her hips with the same nonchalant, maddening perfection with which she knotted scarves around her neck, turned the heads of men, and plenty of women, a third her age, a phenomenon she noticed not one whit. That evening she treated me to the best table at the best restaurant in town. We sat on the bayside deck, feasted, and watched the sunset outdo itself, no doubt turning on the magnificence for my mom, who clapped and called out, "Bravo!" just as it hit its rose gold, magenta, and blue opal peak. We talked and talked. She already knew about the mystery of Blue Sky House, of course, but I told her again anyway, filling in all the details and updating her on the recent Richmond developments. When I was finished and we were forking up strawberry pie, my mother smiled and said, "You and Dev always did love to puzzle things out together." "He'll tell you that he solved all the hardest parts, but really it was me," I said.
"I suspect you solved them together. Two heads are better than one, especially when they're your and Dev's heads."
She paused, then said gravely, "I'm glad you two are back on track. We're all glad." I narrowed my eyes at her. "Just as long as you, all of you, are clear as to exactly which track we're talking about. You're friends, I know." My mother blinked, innocent as a baby. "But why do we need to rubber stamp your and Dev's relationship, or any, as one definite, limited thing?"
"I don't know about any," I said, "but this one is rubber stampable. Trust me."
"I trust you. Now if only you could learn to trust yourself."
"Meaning?"
"You're such a good girl, and I love that about you. But what if you put aside what's appropriate or expected or even noble, and you know how I like nobility? Forget rules and rubber stamps and boundaries and just follow your instincts."
"Are you going to start in about how brain scientists are taking intuition seriously these days? Because I've heard that one."
"From someone very smart, I expect," she said, "who has lovely gray eyes and your best interests at heart."
"They're blue-gray, actually," I said.
"Ah," said my mother, infusing that single syllable with so much complicated meaning that the only thing to do was ignore it. "Anyway, rubber stamp notwithstanding, I'm glad you two are having fun."
"Had fun," I said wistfully. "I guess I'm suffering a little post-adventure depression right now. I wish it weren't over. It somehow doesn't feel over, but it is."
"Maybe it's not. The world is big and life is long. You never know," said my mother, giving a shrug that managed to be chic and wise and jaded and careless all at once. It was the kind of shrug for which words like insouciant and urbane were created. And even though I did know, my mother's shrug was so persuasive that I allowed myself to have a tiny bit of hope.
Later, back at Blue Sky House, we sat on the living room rug with glasses of wine, and I opened the boxes of Edith's and Joseph's photographs, including a few I'd never actually gone through.
"These are marvelous. Oh, I love the exuberance of his, the way she seems like a wild bird or a goddess. Clearly he worshipped her. But I think I like hers of him even more. They're so personal and intimate that I almost feel guilty looking at them. Who knew a photo of the back of someone's head or the inside of his wrist could be so passionate?"
said my mother. "I know," I said, reaching for a stack of photos from one of the previously unexamined boxes. I shuffled through them and then laid them out, one by one, in front of me on the rug.
"Hey," I said, "these aren't Joseph."
"Are you sure?"
said my mother.
"Well, this man is dark-haired too, but much slimmer, narrower in the shoulders. Joseph was a big, muscular guy. And the, I don't know, tenor of them is different from the Joseph pictures."
My mother slid over to look, but after a glance, she scooted back to her own patch of rug and the Joseph photos she had arrayed before her.
"I see what you mean. Those are clever. Arch. I prefer these."
This new batch contained fragments of a man, as did the photos of Joseph, but even though they were just as close in, they were somehow much more distant. Cooler in mood, more full of angles and straight lines, more full of things rather than focusing on the curved, pliant, warm-blooded terrain of skin and sinew. A man's hand holding a glass, his nails smooth, his shirt cuff almost blindingly white. An odd signet ring, flat dark square stone, heavily carved sides, glinting on his left pinky. Fingers holding a wool fedora by the brim. A polished wingtip with a slice of sock-covered ankle. Tip of chin, glimpse of neck, knot of tie. Knuckles of a hand that gripped the oval handle of a leather bag. A hint of a name, unreadable, stamped in what looked like gold beneath the handle. Blurred man in a suit standing at the back window. Elegant shoulders, dark hair. Dark, I noted, so not John. I remembered reading in the newspaper articles about the trial that John Blanchard was blonde. When I turned the photos over, I saw that each had a faint GG penciled in the right-hand corner with a date underneath. I was right about the photos not being of Joseph. All of them were taken during the winter and spring of 1956, when Joseph had been dead for over 3 years. I took out the daylight ledger and examined the entries spanning that time period, but found no one with the initials GG. Then I went further back, and there it was, many months earlier. George Graham. Nothing more. It was the only entry in the entire ledger with no address. If George Graham had come back during the winter and spring of 1956, he hadn't come as a paying guest. I went back to the photos. Could this man have been Edith's lover? It was true that the photos had an air of detachment, but the person in them would have had to have known she was taking them. He and Edith had to have been familiar with each other for her to get so close to him. These clothes and shoes and things, I said. They look expensive and formal, not the kind of thing people typically wear for a beach trip, even in winter. Let me see, said my mother, holding out her hand. Yes, tell me what you think. You're the style star. It was true. Even with her reading glasses resting on the tip of her nose, she looked ridiculously glamorous. I restacked the photos and handed them to her. She stopped on the one with the oval-handled leather bag, set the photo on the floor, and tapped it with her long forefinger. Mark Cross, she said. You mean the name stamped on it? I said. You can read that? But I thought the man's initials were GG. Mark Cross is a leather goods designer, very expensive. It shut down in the 1990s, but was resurrected a couple of years ago. In its new incarnation, the company reissued a lot of its older, classic designs. That's why I recognize this duffel. It was one of the reissues. Is the company based in a particular city? I asked. Maybe a northern city? There was a store on Fifth Avenue, no longer there, but back in the 1950s, I'm pretty sure it would have been. My mother continued to look through the other photos, but I held on to the Mark Cross one, my heart starting to beat hard. Okay, Mom, what if G.G. was Mr. Big City? I mean, maybe it's a long shot, but he was here. Edith knew him well enough to take all these photos. Assuming he's George Graham, he came the first time not long before the first Shadow Ledger guest arrived, and Edith either didn't know his address or was keeping it a secret. Also, the lawyer who represented John Blanchard came from an upper-crust New York firm, and doesn't it seem likely that if John, one of the cogs in Mr. Big City's machine, got in trouble while being a cog, Mr. Big City would do whatever he could to get him out of it? Oh my God, gasped my mother. I know, it really could be him. But when I turned to look at her, her gaze was riveted on a photo in her hand. Mom, did you hear what I said? She looked up at me, staring absently through her glasses, and shook her head.
No, I didn't, sorry. But oh, Claire.
She turned the photo she held around so that I could see it. It was the one of the man's hand holding the glass. Wide-eyed, her voice so breathless I could barely hear it, my mother said, "The ring."
Claire, I know that ring.
Chapter 23. Edith. December 1956. For the first 8 hours of the journey, Edith made things happen. She pressed the gas pedal, and the car accelerated. She pressed the brake, and the car rolled to a stop. She drove through towns, noting their names, the dark gas stations, the church steeples piercing the sky. She drove along deserted roads and watched her headlights carve a tunnel of light for the car to travel through. She passed stands of trees, roadside motor inns with partially burned-out signs. She spoke words of reassurance to Sarah, who lay propped up with a pillow and wrapped in blankets in the back seat, her baby in her arms. She ate a sandwich. She stopped twice, briefly, to stretch her legs, change Stephen's diaper, consult her road atlas, and check on Sarah, who both times eked out a smile and a hoarse, heart-cracking, "I'm fine." Edith grew impatient, wanting to go faster, stick to bigger roads, take a straighter shot, but the only priority greater than getting to where they were going as quickly as possible was not getting caught along the way. So she reasoned with herself, stuck assiduously to the speed limit and to her winding, circuitous route. But just as the sun came up, things began to happen to Edith. The world outside the car windows changed, wavering like a heat shimmer, leaning in to press against the sides of the car or circling around it like a carousel. And the car began to drive itself, hurtling along at 15 miles an hour, crawling at 40, or sitting motionless as the buildings and road signs and trees rushed by it in a blur. To keep herself awake, Edith began to sing, and the songs chose her instead of the reverse. Sometimes she sang without knowing she sang, talked without topic or direction. When she stopped at a gas station, she told the attendant that Sarah was her sister who had recently been in a car accident, that they were going to visit relatives in Maine. She babbled brightly on about blueberries, lobster, bears, and moose, until the attendant said, "You seem a little fatigued, ma'am. Might want to check into a motel and get some sleep." And she said, "As soon as we get to the next town, I promise we'll do just that." She didn't keep the promise, but she came close, pulling the car into a motel parking lot and lying down across the front seat. 4 hours later, a sound woke her. She thought at first it was the baby crying, but it was Sarah, groaning in pain. When Edith turned around, the sight of the woman knocked the wind out of her like a punch. Sarah's eyes were unfocused, her face glazed with sweat, and she trembled as if an invisible person had her by the shoulders and were shaking her until her teeth rattled. Edith got into the back seat, coaxed water and aspirin down Sarah's throat. With great effort, she kept her voice low and soothing, but fear was charging through her, beating out a loud prayer inside her head. "Just let her live. Just let her live. Just let her live. I'll do anything if you just let her live." In the end, that fear is what saved Edith, jolting her out of her fog into an acute, raw wakefulness, sharpening her senses, jerking her attention back on track whenever it began to stray. And Edith believed forever after that it was the baby who saved Sarah. Quiet for the first two-thirds of the trip, as his mother grew sicker, he transformed into a bundle of steely will, of raucous demand, his throaty, mechanical cries making the air inside the car pulse like a migraine as he insisted on his own survival over and over and over. Even when his mother muttered, delirious with fever, wild-eyed as an animal, or when she seemed to slide into and out of unconsciousness, some tiny, clear piece of her remained to hear him and to answer. When Sarah was too weak to hold her head upright, she pressed her son into the curve of her body with an unflagging grip. When she no longer seemed to know where she was, she lifted her shirt and nursed him. By the time they got to the border checkpoint, Edith was so tired that, for a panicked moment, she forgot the words George had told her to say to the guard, but just as she was rolling down the window, she remembered. "We've come all the way from Latrobe to visit our northern cousins," she said, smiling. After a quick glance at Sarah and Stephen in the back seat, the guard delivered his line.
"Latrobe? Isn't that where the banana split was invented?"
"It is," said Edith, with a sigh of relief. "It is indeed." Because of the indirect route, the trip took over 24 hours, so that it was dark when they arrived at the safe house. Edith didn't know what she'd been expecting. A mansion? A fortress? but the sight of the farmhouse set back from the road and a copse of maples took her by surprise. It was so ordinary, so peaceful with its mailbox, its brick walkway, its gabled roofs, its amber porch light, its shaded windows like closed eyes. The young doctor who lived there came out to meet them. He'd been expecting them. "Oh, Lord," he said at the sight of Sarah. "I'll need to get her to the hospital tonight." At Edith's alarmed expression, he said, "Don't worry. There are people there who know, who help. Friends. My mother is a friend, too. She's waiting inside." The next half hour moved around Edith like a dream. She handed over the baby. She heard bathwater running, saw clean pajamas draped over the back of a chair, smelled bread baking. But, reeling with exhaustion, without bathing or eating or changing her clothes, still wearing her winter coat, she tumbled onto the bed and slept. When she woke up, it was the afternoon of the following day. The doctor's name was Thomas Farley. His mother introduced herself as May. Edith took a bath in a clawfoot tub as big as a rowboat, sinking into the steaming water up to her chin. The air smelled of talcum powder and rose water, and Edith wished she could stay right there all day, cradled and weightless, the hot water coaxing the ache and stiffness from her muscles. She washed her hair and dressed in the clothes she'd hastily packed, another of Joseph's sweaters and a pair of blue jeans. Examining her reflection in the bathroom mirror, she shook her head and said, "Aren't you a sight?" And then, following the fragrance of bacon, she went down to find May. When she walked into the kitchen, May turned, spatula in hand. She was diminutive, pink-cheeked from the hot stove, her gray hair cropped. She should have been a cute old lady, but somehow she wasn't. May gave Edith a fleeting once-over, and then, without remarking on her appearance, turned back to the stove, where an egg danced in a skillet. She flipped it in a glory of sputtering and said, grinning, "I know it's almost 4 o'clock, but I figured it was breakfast time for you." "Thank you," said Edith. "I'm ravenous, and that smells like heaven. But how is Sarah?"
"After you eat," said May sternly, "and no rushing. I can only imagine what you've been through, driving all that way through the cold and dark with a sick woman and an infant. First and foremost, your body needs nourishment."
She placed a plate of eggs and bacon and fresh buttered bread before Edith, and then stood watching while she ate it. For all her kindness, there was something commanding about May, rooted there in her kitchen, keen-eyed and upright and stalwart, like a soldier or a lighthouse. Not until Edith had eaten every bite, and it didn't take long, and May had taken her plate away and brought her a mug of tea thick with cream, did she sit down next to Edith at the table, fold her hands before her, and say, "About Sarah. Is she all right?"
"Not yet," said May, shaking her head. "She's got a rough road ahead of her. They had to take out her spleen, and that's a long recovery all by itself. But she's got an infection as well, which has sent her into shock. An infection without a spleen to help fight it off. Well, I won't sugarcoat it. Thomas is worried sick."
Edith's chest tightened, and she grabbed onto the arms of her wooden chair.
"Don't do it," said May. "Whatever you're second-guessing yourself about, just don't."
"I had to try to bring her here," Edith said, gasping. "She insisted. But there was a time when we stopped and I slept because I was just so tired that nothing felt real or made sense. And when I woke up, I knew she had taken a turn for the worse, the much, much worse. And I shouldn't have slept or I should have taken her to a hospital right then and..."
May held up her hand. "Stop. You should have done just what you did."
"But..."
"She deserved her chance at freedom and a good life. And she may get it yet. She's young and has got good doctors and has her baby to live for. Sarah shot her husband to save her baby's life and her own. Any woman who can do that has a fighting chance at the very least."
"She can't die. She just can't."
May reached out and moved a lock of Edith's damp hair off her cheek. a brusque, tender act that made Edith, for the first time since she was a little child, miss her mother, of whom she had not a single clear memory.
"Don't let yourself get worked up," said May. "It isn't good for you."